gentlemen.
True Lutheran style, I don't have to say good morning.
Bring a wife along. We had a workshop before this one, and we threw a couple women in. Trust you've all had a good weekend. I understand the worship service had more people in than was expected. The past week, as I sort of looked at it, focused in on mixing up the knots, getting together, a little heavy on process. As a few of you told me when we went to two workshops and discovered certain similarities from one day to another. We're confident that in this week, the subject matter will probably be much heavier than process. I shouldn't say the subject matter will be that heavy stuff, but it will be a content-directed week. And hopefully that this week you'll begin to get some handles on items that you can put together in order to maintain a new direction or a fresh direction in your ministry in the year ahead. The gentleman that we have with us this morning, Dr. Lyle Starr, will be particularly helpful, along with a number of the other workshops during the week, to zero us in on specific subject areas that have immediate concern to all of us as it pertains to our parishes and working with parishes. I hope that before this hour is up, and my secretary brings in a news sheet that we took to the print shop Friday night that lists the two items that are up here and a few other notices that may help you this week. I'll not refer to those, but we should do a new sheet to give you a little more. I must do this. I'm sorry, I started to read while my mind picked up a few other things. If you are interested in the workshop this afternoon at 3:30 to 5 on Black Theology, Pete Carroll is going to role play Jim Cone. Pete Carroll is a Black pastor working on his doctorate here this summer, or this past year and next year. He'll be role playing Jim Cone, the Black theologian at Union Seminary. And then Andy Warman and Pete will enter into something of a critique from a Lutheran perspective of the current Black theology vogue as represented by Gina Cole.
Where will that be?
They will say that in that news sheet. Okay, it's in one of these rooms. Or watch the easel out here for an announcement. But if you're going to attend that, we have a synopsis or an abbreviated form indicating what Jim Cone's theology is, what he's really trying to say. It's an abbreviated form, obviously, particularly in his recent book on Black Theology and Black Power. So if you anticipate attending that workshop at 3:30, it will be most helpful for you to pick up a copy of this. I'll leave them here or out and some out on that table. We don't have an excess amount. So pick it up only if you plan to read it and attend that workshop. My secretary just indicated the print shop will not have the notices available by 9 o'clock. Sometime today we'll be distributing that sheet. Lyle also, you want me to hand this out for you, Lyle? Lyle has available a little document for everyone here, and those who are not here at 8 will pick up later. Did anyone not get theirs? It looks like we're discriminating. The consultants get a fancier one. That's only because there's something, he has an extra essay in one of these on consulting services of district leaders. Come and get one. What's going on?
Okay, let me introduce that person. I would say Professor Doctor, and he does not welcome either of those titles. Lionel Schaller has been associated with the Lutheran Church, and even though he is a Methodist clergyman, for a great number of years. My contact with Lionel goes back some time when he was in Ohio, in the Cleveland area, and functioned in a consulting relationship, I know with the English district, I'm quite sure, with Ohio at the same time as a consultant, as a church planner. Since those years in Ohio, he has been in Naperville, associated with a center for parish renewal, doing a great deal of lecturing, employed by LCMS, various staff levels, Board of Stewardship, you know, recently. He has written prolifically. For all of those of you who watch the reviews and purchase and read books, you know him well. The purpose of this hour is to give you a chance to become acquainted with Lyle, and he'll be setting forth some of his concerns as he sees them now for the parish ministry. I'll also give you a chance toward the end to ask questions, and he may be looking at that little catalog to help you understand what he intends to do in specific time slots so that you can be sure that's when you want to meet with him to gain from Lyle those insights, skills that particularly relate or that relate to your particular needs. We're happy to give you this week Lyle Schaller, in addition to all the other resource leaders that you'll be meeting. Lyle?
Some of you may have heard the story of the three stonemasons who were working on a construction new building. Someone came along and asked, "What are you doing?" And one said, "I'm making $5.75 an hour." The second one said, "I'm building a wall." The third one said, "I'm building a cathedral, the glory of God, where people can come and worship God and go forth to be inspired in his service." They fired him on the spot because the plans called for a technical plan. This is a little bit of what we sometimes have, is the extravagant rhetoric, which may deviate quite a bit from the performance. I think it's a part of the problem we have in the society as a whole today, where the rhetoric occasionally gets away from the performance, and expectations exceed performance. And I think we have, without any references to Watergate, certain kinds of credibility problems. My concerns here are basically with the parish, and if I may depersonalize this somewhat, and hopefully I won't sound too negative, largely with the pastor as a pastor rather than as a person. Now, I'm interested in the pastor as a person. Most of what I know, I learn from pastors. Most of what we'll be talking about in these days, I stole from other pastors. Occasionally I give credit, but usually not. And so I'm indebted to the people in the pastorate, but basically we'll be functioning on the role of the clergyman as a pastor and as a pastor in the parish. We have a session or two on other subjects, and that's the reason for the distinction. I thought the simplest way to define these for the consultant staff type of person would be to bind with plastic, although our 16-year-old son who does this feels it's faster just to staple them. And so he's glad that we made the division the way we did, and there aren't any more consultants here. We will be looking, a few of us, spending time with a church here in St. Louis, which I was with last fall, and using that as a little bit of a case study in terms of the what's happening in the church today. Otherwise, we'll hang on for a few minutes as far as any other comments or questions you may have about this. And I think part of what we're doing here is getting acquainted. I need to get acquainted with you, and you need to get acquainted with me, and then we can talk more helpfully with one another. I'd like to take a few minutes here and talk about what I see as the role of a pastor in two different respects. One is as a leader, and the other is as a person with major responsibilities in the operation of a complex institution. And I say complex institution, if you have a parish that has more than 40 or 50 resident members, reasonably active resident members, then we're talking about a complex institution. And we sometimes treat larger congregations with 80 and 100 and 150 members as relatively simple institutions, and they're very complex. And if you get up with 200 or 300 confirmed members, why, then we have a very complex organization. And if you somehow made the mistake of accepting a call to a parish with 1,000 or more communicants, then you have an organization that's probably too complex for us to deal with here, but we'll tackle it anyway. The things I say here, I suppose, could be said in terms of a bias, and I will label it that because some of this is quite subjective. I think one of the problems we have in the church today is a result, and pardon me for saying this way, Mr. Seminary Professor, of what happened in some seminaries where for about 25 years we had courses in pastoral counseling, pastoral care, which emphasized a non-directive approach to counseling. And a lot of folks thought they were taking a course in church administration. I think that a pastor as a leader, and I'm not trying to suggest he is the only leader in the parish, but as one of the leaders in the parish, the pastor has responsibility to lead. And in many cases, we have done somewhat the same thing we have done with young parents. Through various communication devices, we have convinced a lot of young parents that it's absolutely impossible for any couple to raise a child in today's society. And I think we've convinced some pastors that it's impossible to be an effective leader in the parish. I don't think so. I run into literally hundreds of pastors who are very effective leaders in the parish. And as I say, I think one definition of a leader is that's someone who leads. I think that a part of this, and at least my perspective on this question, goes back to a book by a man by the name of Greenleaf. About 3 years ago, he published a book called The Servant as Leader. And in this, he expressed a concept that I had not encountered either before nor since in one certain dimension, and I'll identify that in a minute. But basically, he begins with the idea that one of the distinctive dimensions of man, and I guess here I can sort of relax and be my own male chauvinist pig self, and talk about men. Our 18-year-old daughter is in the process, or at least she's working at the process, of training me not to go oink, oink, but to speak about lay persons and about people and so on and so forth. But here I think I can relax and be myself and talk about the doctrine of man and things like this. One of the characteristics that Greenleaf lifts up of the nature of man is that unlike other creatures, he has the ability to, in a sense, stand outside of himself and look at himself and look at his environment. And while our younger daughter thinks our cat has the same ability, we don't know for sure. Now, Greenleaf's point is that a leader is a person who, while he is a part of the group of which he is one of the leaders, also has the capability of moving outside that group and, in a sense, standing out here and looking at where it is and where it's going and the implications of where it's going, and makes the point, if you use the decision tree concept for a moment, that as we come to a fork in the road and we make a choice, then that leads us to another fork down the road, and we make a choice, which then leads us to another fork down the road, and that one of the obligations of a leader is to look far enough down the road that he prevents the group from being locked in to two no-win alternatives at one of these forks in the road. Now, another way to say that is, I suppose, is in the vernacular, keep the options open. But we don't always keep the options open in the way Greenleaf suggests. We sometimes keep them open between a fourth-rate choice and a fifth-rate choice. Greenleaf suggests, and this is, I think, the distinctive contribution, is that the leader who fails to exercise that kind of responsibility in looking down the road, not at the immediate decision before us, and not at the immediate consequences of that, but one step beyond, and fails to recognize that occasionally a group can lock itself into two choices, both of which are losers, the leader who does not exercise that kind of leadership is guilty of an ethical failure. This is the first time I've seen it put quite that way. Now, whether you want to put the ethical or moral implications on this, I'm not sure, but I would suggest that a part of the responsibility of the parish pastor is to be able to look down the road and to raise questions about the implications and to raise questions about what does this do as far as alternatives are concerned. Let me give you a few simple illustrations. One of the patterns we have all across the church, but particularly in the area that begins perhaps with Illinois and runs west for several states, is a pattern that because of the size of communities and the size of parishes, we quite often link two congregations together and have them served by one pastor. And so we would have Church A there and Church B there. Those aren't really biblical names, but we're using them for the moment. And we have these served by one pastor. We have a lot of these, for example, with the LCA in Pennsylvania. Now, one of the patterns that I think I see that reflects on the point of leadership here, if I may expand this now, is that if we have several small congregations like this, each of which is too small to either justify the time and energy or to be able to pay the salary of a full-time pastor, what we tend to do is look and say, well, let's tie these two together, and we'll tie these two together, and we'll tie those two together, and make two church parishes out of each of these. Now, what are the implications of this? And this is the point we're trying to illustrate rather than deal with the content of it. One is that we tend to say it's best that we tie those two that are close together to one another and relate those. This means that there will be certain kinds of pressures, perhaps self-created pressures, on the pastor and on some of the members of the parish to have those two congregations do things together. And perhaps that they should unite and become one congregation. It makes it easy, for example, with some of these that are just a few miles apart, to be in one for part of the afternoon and the other part of the afternoon, or perhaps to be in each one in the same evening, and so on and so forth. As I work with this type of situation, I become quite impressed with the results that happen when you have two congregations that are related, served by the same pastor in this way. They're at least 45 minutes apart. Now, 45 minutes is not too many miles in some places, and it's quite a few miles in others. And I suppose we're talking anywhere from 15 to 60 miles, depending how fast you drive and so on and so forth. one of the implications of this, and again what I'm trying to say, is it might be, you see, that these be the two that we serve by the same pastor, is that he knows where he is all the time. And this is pretty important. And that he makes much better use of his time. And he does not have the kinds of pressures that sometimes occur if these are 5 or 10 miles apart. We do this together, do that together, maybe, you know, urge them to become one congregation, so on and so forth. Now, it seems to me what I'm trying to say here, you see, is that as we look at those kinds of arrangements, they do illustrate the question. Let's look at the implications of each of the alternatives and which one will produce the better results if we have two, or the best if we have 6 or 8 alternatives. And it also, I think, lifts up another kind of illustration that we need to keep in mind as we talk about leadership, and that is rarely do we solve problems in these kinds of arrangements. What we tend to do is trade one set of problems for a different set of problems. In this kind of arrangement, which set of problems do you want to have? Those that go with close geographical proximity, or those that go with the congregations being separated by roughly 45 minutes or so, maybe an hour driving time? Each one has advantages, each one has disadvantages. And the point I'm simply trying to say is that as we look at these, we don't automatically use a map and say, well, we tie those two that are closest together and have them served by one pastor. We have a number of other considerations that I think are much more important. And I think a leader's role is to help identify some of these somewhat more subtle considerations, or less obvious considerations, and to lift up the implications of each of the alternatives. Another type of role for the parish pastor as a leader, and some of you perhaps have experienced this, and we'll see an illustration of it later this week at Watson Terrace, is the congregation that for one reason or another gets involved in a major building program, or if we can make it a little bit more complex and use a fairly common illustration, a relocation from one spot to a new location and the construction of a new meeting place. And frequently this takes 5, 10, 12, 14 years, sometimes 20 years to carry through. In other words, from the time the planning starts until the building, the last unit is constructed, and the mortgage is either paid off or reduced to the point that nobody worries about it. Now, we have a process here which is very common and tends to run in the same kind of series of steps, which is that we set out in this congregation a highly visible, measurable, in the minds of some people, almost unachievable, in the minds of some people, completely unachievable, goal. And 10, 12, 15, 20 years later, we have moved toward this, and we have achieved it. We relocated, built a new building, paid for it. Then typically we have a pattern which I describe simply as post-building blues that sets in, which is, if I may put in the vernacular, how do you top that act? I haven't run into this now for 6 days in terms of any first-hand encounters with that kind of situation, but we do have quite a few. We have a fair number in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod that I'm acquainted with personally. And what it means, if I may go back to the leadership role, is that we do not identify these as relocation and building and financing issues, but we put them under a larger umbrella, which is, if I may use that word here, the matter of goals. And that as we move toward the accomplishment, or achievement, whatever word you want to use, of this type of goal, seems to me the leader has some responsibilities to look down the road and say, what are going to be the consequences of achieving that goal? What are the probable implications if we carry this through? Unless there's some intervention with the normal processes that we see at work, we have someone saying, and perhaps none of you have ever heard this phrase, but it goes something like this in some churches, you know, What we need is another building program. Because this congregation really, you know, had loyalty and commitment and devotion and dedication and enthusiasm and all those words back when we were in the building program. And now things are kind of dull and lethargic and it's hardly, barely moving. And if we could, you know. Or the phrase, a church does best when it has a mortgage to pay off. You know, that's when things are really humming. I think those are oversimplifications of a process that we can look at in a larger context and say more precisely that a congregation tends to do better when it has visible, measurable, achievable goals and is making progress toward accomplishing these that people can be conscious of. And a building program or paying off the mortgage, those kinds of things, are simply illustrations of this that we've seen over and over. Another way we can look at the same question of the role of the leader is when a lay person comes into the meeting and says, hey, you know what we ought to do? And has this brilliant idea. And everybody there, in the normal fashion, pours cold water on it. And he goes home and says to his wife, you know, I sometimes wonder why I ever go to church council meetings. I got a bunch of idiots there, and if I had a little bit more sense, I'd stay away from them because it may be contagious. Now, what he's running into is a very normal pattern, which, again, the pastor as a leader can help him understand. One of these is that most of us are built in such a way that we normally reject any new idea the first time it's broached. And this is what those folks did. Next week's the 4th of July, isn't it? 28 years ago, next week, I met a lovely young lady in Nashville, Tennessee, and I said to her, you know, I got a good idea. What you ought to do is you ought to marry me. And in the normal, predictable fashion, she rejected a new idea the first time she heard it. But understanding this whole process, I was persistent. And so she subsequently said yes, and so now she's home with a car. Whatever that means. We don't always foresee all the implications of all of these things, and when you start talking about six children, why, that was not a part of my, you know, great idea, but it was a good idea. My wife and I, were both among the earliest people to get on the sort of ecology kick, and I think we were probably one of the originators of the slogan that you so often hear, that you should have only as many children as it takes to replace you. And that's what we did. Yeah. But anyway, the point I'm trying to say here is that we have a normal pattern, which is when somebody comes in with this brilliant idea, people throw cold water on it, and he goes home and wonders what's wrong with him. And it seems to me the pastor here, you see, has a role as a leader and as a pastor in which he explains that, look, you know, just because they said no the first time, all that really means is that if it's a formal no, then you have it on the agenda. If it's an informal no, then you don't know just where you are. I'm serious when I say that. Most ideas that are subsequently implemented get on the agenda, and ideas for, I mean, major changes, what I'm talking about here, get on the agenda, so to speak, in an official sense, by being rejected. For example, we have many congregations which, to go back to the illustration a moment ago, did relocate. And that got on the agenda by somebody proposing it and it being rejected. And then you see you're ready to talk about it. Or congregations which went into building programs and somebody, you know, proposes this, and it gets on the agenda formally or informally, and it's rejected. And then they're ready to deal with it. And so all that the no says is you now probably have it on the agenda. If they say yes and go ahead and implement it, then, you know, that's it. You can't very well reverse that one, especially after it's done. But the no is reversible. Another kind of pattern, and I simply want to lift up a few illustrations of this, is that I see the pastor as a leader in terms of, if you want to use the word, counselor, advisor on how decisions are made in the parish. And occasionally he will raise questions, occasionally make suggestions on maybe there's a better way to do it than what we're talking about here, and let's think about it and talk about it some more. And we go on and begin to develop a better way of doing it. Let me use an illustration. This happened to be three small congregations in Wisconsin, which was served by one pastor. And one of the buildings was in extraordinarily poor condition, and as turned out and was predicted, expected, was padlocked one day by the state fire marshal as not suitable for public assemblage. The three congregations appointed a joint committee consisting originally of four persons from each congregation and later enlarged to be six persons from each congregation. And so these 18 people with a pastor met and did an extraordinarily serious analysis of the situation. It's about as good a model as you could get, with one or two exceptions, of how two or three congregations together can sit down and study a matter of mutual concern and work through the alternatives and come out with a proposal. There are a couple of exceptions to that generalization, but it was very, very, very thorough. And when they got through, out of the 18 voting members, if I remember correctly, said, yes, this is the only alternative we have, and two abstained because they both said, this is, you know, we're too old and we don't have a right to propose this because we won't be here to see it all the way through. They weren't objecting, they just didn't feel that they had a right because of their age to support it. And the proposal said, in effect, the present arrangement is completely untenable. We simply cannot go along the way we are. And therefore, we recommend that these three congregations unite, become one congregation, and build a new meeting place on what was described as the Cole, C-O-L-E, property. This was some land owned by a farmer in the community who had offered to give it to the church if they wanted a place for a new meeting place. And so this was presented to a vote, and each congregation voted on this separately on the same Sunday. And I don't remember the exact detail of the vote, except on one side of it. And the vote was approximately, the number here I don't recall exactly, about 80 no, and about 19 yes. Yeah, this was either 18 or 19, I kind of forgot. I know it's quite embarrassing because most of these people were married, and as they looked at that total and looked at this total, they began to realize that most of them couldn't even persuade their spouse to go along with it. Now, what happened? Well, three or four things happened. Several months later, for example, I met one of the leading laypersons from the congregation and a lady who was involved on the committee, and one of the women involved in the committee, which obviously proves it's not a Missouri Synod situation. And I said, how are things going? And we had met, and we were fairly good, you know, we were somewhere between acquaintances and friends, and so this was not, you know, a stranger walking up to her by any means. And I said, you know, how are things going? And she simply burst into tears. The pastor literally lost his voice for about 3.5 or 4 months, which I think has some, if you believe in psychosomatic illnesses, I think is explainable. Now, what happened? what the committee did is a very thorough study, came out with what was obviously the only sensible answer, and says, in effect, you know, we've studied this, and there really is only one thing to do. And so let's do it. And they had a vote like you see, which was they did not go through the process of building any allies. The other thing they did is they did something which, if this had been, I used to be in municipal government in a previous incarnation, which if this were a municipal government in Wisconsin, would have been illegal. And that is that they put three questions on the same referendum question. In other words, merge, build a new meeting place at this location. Three different questions. You could be for two of these, but opposed to the third. And so that many people who favored the merger, but opposed building a new building rather than expanding the building owned by the middle congregation, or who favored building a new building, but opposed that particular location, they each had to vote no. And this is one of the reasons for this vote. I'm simply suggesting that this is a place where a pastor is one of the leaders, and it seems to me that he can make some suggestions on the process that we use and the probable implications of the process that's under discussion. In other words, will this take us down into a choice between no-win, you know, two no-win situations? We can't stay where we are, that's untenable, and we can't do anything else. What else to do except you lose your voice? Can't speak to that question, you see. Now, the other comment I'd like to make, or set of comments, would be in relationship to the institution. A parish is a very complex institution. And if you have more than, and I'll use a fairly high figure here, if you have more than 40 reasonably active resident members, you have a complex organization. If you have 6 or 8 or 12 or 14 resident members, that's different, and we're not talking about those. But if you have a large congregation, 40 or more members, that's different. One of the differences is that when you have a large congregation of 50 or 75 members, then you have an assortment of people too large, even if they all had compatible interests, too large to be one effective group. And you're talking about a congregation which has to be dealt with either as a congregation of groups of people as well as a congregation of individuals. Or if you treat it as a congregation of individuals, eventually you can get enough people to stay away that you get it down to the size that you can have a group. But by and large, I think it's better, you see, to look at it as an institution and say that we're dealing here both with individuals as individual persons and as groups of people. And if you have a large congregation of 200 or 300 members, then you see you're dealing with a very complex thing because you have a relatively large number of groups, and many of these are overlapping in terms of membership. We tend to look at congregations with 75 members, confirmed members, as small parishes. And they aren't. They're large, complex organizations, and when we talk about this as a small, simple kind of organization, we are allowing ourselves some difficulties which I think could be prevented. I have a friend who's a Southern Presbyterian, and he was once, years ago, the assistant pastor of what was then the largest Presbyterian church in the Presbyterian Church U.S., church in Dallas. And he's a very astute person, and as he was there, he said one time, you know, when you're in a parish this size with something like 3,500 community members, you're not a shepherd, you're a rancher. And I think he had a very good analogy there, that one of the things a rancher does, as I understand it, is he has a lot of different herds of cattle scattered around the range, And he's concerned about each of these, but he doesn't want to get them all in one place at one time. And this is the same kind of thing, I think, when you have a large parish. You need to be, you know, watching the different herds in the different fields. Now, when we talk about the pastor as a leader of an institution, and a complex institution, and if you're the pastor of a congregation of 15 or 18 members, that's a whole different ballgame than we're talking about here. But if you have a relatively large congregation, we're talking about the role of the pastor as a leader in a large, complex organization. And as perhaps one of the few leaders in that organization who sees it that way. Which means he has some rather unique leadership responsibilities. Because most lay people tend, there's nothing wrong with their seeing it this way. I shouldn't say that. There's nothing wrong with them that they see it this way. It's simply the way society is, that we tend to be influenced by the exceptional rather than by the typical. And so we see and we read about, and there's publicity attached to the parish of 500 or 800 or 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 members. And the person who's in a congregation that averages 150 at worship on Sunday morning says, you know, gee whiz, this is just a little tiny operation. And, you know, you look at St. Paul's over there, and, you know, look at this. And what we ought to do, and what he's saying, you see, is in the context of how I see our congregation against that huge one over there, thus and so. And that ain't the way it is. Even in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I think the way it is. And so we have, over and over, suggestions, ideas, proposals, which tend to be, let us consolidate this or do that, and operate, you see, as a parish, you know, one large group. And this tends to be counterproductive. And most people will tend to see it that way. Now, these same individuals will function in other parts of their life where they are not directly involved in the organizational life of the church, in a society which observes what I would suggest might be called the rule of 40. And that is, if you get more than 40 people in one place, that's too many. I haven't counted here, but we're, you know, a little above that, yeah. Anybody... wife teaches like fourth grade or sixth grade or, you know, third grade. Your wife teaches what grade?
Third and fourth.
Third and fourth. How many youngsters in that class? 16. What would she say if she came and because of some organization, there were 42? Either they'd change or she'd leave. Now, this is normal. What we have done all through society is we have said, when you get more than 35 or 40 people, that's too many. And let's divide it up. We do it in schools. We do it in service clubs. The Amish do it. When you get more than 40 families in the congregation, they divide into two congregations. We do it in business organizationally, and we talk with span of control, you know, which typically is 6 or 7 or 8. We do it in the military. We do it all up and down the line. And we say in one way or another, a good number is somewhere between 7 or 8 and maybe 30. But 40, that's too many, except in the church. Then you see we want these big numbers. And all I'm trying to suggest here is that we're dealing with a very complex institution in the church, which tends frequently to behave like, or I should say more like, an institution than it does like a religious institution or organization. And a part part of the role of the pastor, it seems to me, as a parish pastor, is to look at the parish as a complex organization and to help other people see it that way, rather than as a small, simple, easy-to-understand organization. And this is for him and for others. Now, if he doesn't believe it or doesn't understand it, then he's not likely to be very helpful to others. Let me just simply illustrate this in this little booklet. If the pages are all numbered, and you're welcome to number them, what would be about page 11 is a sheet that looks like this, hopefully, if they're all put together the same way. And I immediately disclaim responsibility since our 16-year-old put them together. It says, Foundations for Expectations. And if you look at that for a moment, let me ask any parish pastor here, how many people do you have at worship on Sunday morning? Anybody? 600? Somebody else? 250? Anybody else? 40? That's more like it. 75. That's a good number back there. 75. We're going to freeze it at 75. That's a good number. Now, you see this little box here? If you took all of the congregations in American Protestantism and using worship attendance as the index of size, where would 75 at worship be? And would it be where you draw a line and say, well, 75, 25% are smaller than that, and 75% are larger, and therefore that would be at the 25 percentile? Or would you say it's 50-50, in other words, about half the congregations have more than 75 and half have fewer than 75? Or would you put it up here at 100% and say nobody has more than that, except maybe, you know, a fraction of 1%? How large is a congregation of 75? I'm asking this gentleman in the blue shirt. On that scale, you understand my question? Yeah. That's all right. You've had long enough. In other words, 75% would be smaller and 25% would be larger? Is that what you're saying?
Probably
50-50. 50-50. Mm-hmm. Anybody else understand the question when it has it, I guess? Yes. You'd say around half would be larger and half smaller.
No.
Oh. Yeah. Anybody else? Well, now let me make sure that we understand who's here. There ain't no layman in the room, if you all agree with that. If you turn over the page, it says he's right on the button. Because as near as we can figure, 75 is the dividing mark between about half of the congregations have more than that at worship on Sunday morning, about half have fewer. Now, if you go home and try this, friend, on your folks, and use the procedure described here, I will guarantee you, this is money back, you get your money back for this, that not more than 2 out of those 10 or 20 people you have assembled you try it with will give you a number as high as 50, unless they don't understand the question. Because most people who are, and by most I mean like 95% of people who are members of congregations that average 75 at worship say, you know, we're just a little tiny out, you know, there's not much. And they say, you know, gee whiz, we're hardly big enough to even, you know, get on the chart, sort of. Now, the point I'm trying to make here in this particular yellow sheet, which we won't go into now, is that a part of the role of the pastor is to help people understand reality and who they are and what they are as an organization, institution. and there's trouble procedures described there which may be helpful.